How's everybody?
Terrific.
Good. Wonderful. We better get off of numbers before there's nobody left here. next week, I think. Yeah, next week we'll begin Deuteronomy. So this is the last school kind of numbers. Let's have a word of prayer. I don't know if we have any housekeeping things, but if we do, we'll have a word of prayer. We'll do some housekeeping if we have any. We'll read some numbers. 15, 92, 13. And then we'll go do something important. How does that sound?
Good.
The Lord be with you.
Also with you.
Let us pray. Blessed Lord, who has caused all scriptures to be written for our instruction, teach us. Teach us so to hear them, to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, that we may embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life that you have given to us through our Lord Jesus Christ, to whom with you and the Holy Spirit be all honor and glory, world without end.
Amen.
Beautiful. Yeah, I guess the only housekeeping thing is, yeah, this is the last Sunday for Numbers. Before we get to it, again, this is my favorite story in Numbers. When I teach Old Testament in a whole year as opposed to in 45 years, the way I'm doing it here, when I teach Old Testament in a single year, this is the only story we read from Numbers. And so, and since I'm the one wearing the bow tie, I get to choose what we read. And so this is actually a very important story. Just to review where we are sort of in the larger story. In the beginning of Exodus, we left Egypt. We were in slavery. We left Egypt. Moses and God brought us out by means of the Red Sea. What happened there at the Red Sea is a little iffy. But something happened there at the Red Sea. And at the end of that story, Egypt is no more. And we're free. We're no longer in Egypt. We go down to Sinai. We spend just about a year at Sinai. And in that year, what happens is that God gives us the Ten Commandments. God gives us something called the Covenant Code. It sort of explains the way in which those Ten Commandments sort of work in everyday life. God gives us plans for the holy place that he's supposed to be worshipped. That is the tabernacle, the holy tent. We build that. God gives us all sorts of rules about the way in which we're supposed to live with God and with each other. That is the book of Leviticus. And then here at the book of Numbers, God gives us a few more rules, sort of at the beginning of the book. And we set out, after about a year being at Sinai, and we set out for the land that God promised us long time ago. In fact, God brought us out of the land of Egypt in order to bring us into the land of Canaan. Oh, yes, absolutely. There's time. Actually, why don't you take it, just in case anyone else comes. That's awesome. Thank you. And so finally, we set out from Sinai, and we head out. And before we head out, one of the things God says is, let's just take a census of the people and just see how many people we've got here, right? And we've got a lot of people. So we take a census. There's 36 chapters in the book of Numbers. The story that we're about to read occurs sort of in the middle, a little bit before the middle. As the result of this story, in about 13 more chapters, God's going to say, get another census together of the people. And the reason why the first census isn't going to be so helpful for the second census is because of this story. There's going to be something very important that happens in this story, so that we have to have a second census of the people that occurs in chapter 26. And you can imagine why we have to have another census. It's not going to wind up very well. But anyway, it'll wind up fine at the end, but we'll see. We'll see about this. So here we are, the turning point. And it really is the turning point in my sort of conception of the book. Yeah, chapters 1 through 25 is the first census. Chapters 26 through 36 is the second census. But in fact, it's this story that occurs right sort of in the middle of Numbers. It actually is the turning point of the book and the reason why it's called the Book of Numbers. And that is the reason why there are two different numberings of the people. And it's probably one of the more famous, if not the most famous story in the whole Book of Numbers. Let's see what we got here. The Lord said to Moses, before we get started, I'm sorry, just one more little footnote. This story is actually so important, in fact, that we're going to see this story again. Moses is going to retell this story to us in the Book of Deuteronomy. And so y'all are very special, actually, this morning. You're really blessed to be able to hear the Numbers version of the story. But as I've said before, God never gives a blessing without giving a test. And that is that Moses is going to retell this story when we get over onto Deuteronomy. However, he's going to retell it in a very different way. This is what we call revisionist history when we get around to Deuteronomy. And so sort of pay attention this morning, and I'll point out some things this morning. Just be aware so that when we get around to Deuteronomy, and I think that's probably going to be in about 2 or 3 weeks, you'll be able to hear the two different versions of this. Cool. Okay, here we go. The Lord said to Moses, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. We'll stop right there. Whose idea is it to send spies? No, I'm not trying to trick you. Just tell me what's obvious. Whose idea is it to send spies? God's idea. Yeah, so God tells Moses to send the spies into the land of Canaan. Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm giving to the Israelites. From each of their ancestral tribes, and there are 12 of these things, right? From each of their ancestral tribes, you shall send a man, everyone a leader among them. So you sort of get all the heads of those various tribes together, and they're the ones that are going to go out into the land of Canaan to see what it's like. And so Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of the Lord, all of them leading men among the Israelites. Right now they're in a place, I thought I wasn't going to write on the board, but I guess I will write on the board.
Watch how fast I can do this if I practice. Okay. Zoom. Here's Israel. Cool. This is the Mediterranean over here. There's the fish. Actually, it's a whale. We heard from Jonah this morning, so that's Jonah right there. Cool. Down here is Egypt. This is the Sea of Galilee. This is the Jordan River. This is the Dead Sea. They've been in Sinai. Right about here, and they've come up from Sinai in a period of about, a month or two, to just about right here. So they're going to go into this land. This is the land of Canaan. Where they're supposed to live. They go up to a place called Kadesh Barnea, which is right about there, which is in Paran, which is what we just read. So the whole point is they're right about here, and when Moses sends these people, as God commanded them, into them, they're going to go up, and up, and up, and up, and up, and view it, and then come back and give a report. So, spoiler alert, that's what the story's going to be. So far, so good?
Yes. Yeah, cool. So, Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of the Lord, all of them leading men among the Israelites. And these were their names. Blah, 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 blah. Is anybody related to any of these people? I don't think so. So we don't need to cover that. Cool. Excellent. If you're offended, then we can go ahead and read them, but I'd rather not. It's stuff like this. This is the reason why people don't become lectors in church. Right? These were the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land. And Moses changed the name of Hoshea, the son of Nun, to Joshua. So maybe you've heard of Joshua. Well, he has a whole book of the Bible. And we'll get to him maybe in the spring. So anyway, Moses changed the name of Hoshea, the son of Nun, to Joshua. Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, go up there into the Negev, and then go up into the hill country and see what the land is like, whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they're few or many, whether the land they live in is good or bad, whether the towns that they live in are unwalled or they're fortified, that is, walled or unwalled, whether the land is rich or poor, and whether there are trees in it or not. Trees are really, really important. I don't know if you know anything about trees. Trees take a long time to grow. You can't just sort of plant one in the next season. There's a tree. So trees are really important. So you got to find out if there's trees or not. Because you don't, if there's no trees, then it's going to take a while to get all those things like apples and pears and all those types of things. Whether there are trees in it or not, be bold and bring some of the fruit of the land. And it was the season of the first ripe grapes. Maybe the fall, I don't know. I don't know when grapes grow. I assume first ripe grapes are sometime in the fall, into the summer. And so they went up and they spied out the land for the wilderness of Zin to Rehob near Lebo Hamat. And then they went up to the Negev. And then they came to Hebron. Hebron is right about where that arrow ends, right there at the top. So that's about where Hebron is. They come to Hebron. And then the narrator tells us, now Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the Anakites, were there. You know who these people are? No, nobody does. either. But anyway, it seems as though whoever it was that's telling this story, the people that they're telling this to, sort of says, oh my God, not Ahiman! But anyway, it's still a bit lost. I don't know who the Anakites are either. But anyway, Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, yikes, the Anakites are there. And they came to the Wadi Eshkol. And they cut down there a branch with a single cluster of grapes. And sort of my parenthetical statement here, it was so huge that they carried it on a pole between them. When I was a little kid, again, you sort of look back at your life and you can sort of see destiny working, right? When I was a little kid, I had a children's Bible that was given to me by my aunt Peggy. And it was a big, thick thing with pictures in it. And Jesus was blonde-haired and blue-eyed. It was just perhaps not historically accurate. But anyway, there's a picture of this story, actually. And there's a couple of guys, and they have a pole, and they have a bunch of grapes. And the grapes are the size of, like, basketballs. You know, these huge, huge grapes, you know. That's not the picture that's here. They're carrying these things on the pole between them, because the cluster is so big, not that the grapes are so big. So it's not like you're carrying basketballs. Grapes are normal size, but there's just so many of them to a cluster that you can't lift one up. You can't carry a cluster, right? And so this huge 90-pound cluster of grapes from a single cluster is so huge that they have to carry it on a pole between. Does that make sense? Yeah, okay, cool. Thank you, Aunt Peggy.
Roy,
yeah.
The Bible they use in children's chapel now shows it exactly the same way.
Oh, a huge basketball? Oh, really? Yeah, we need to work on that. Cool. They also brought some pomegranates and some figs. And the name of that place was called Wadi Eshkol. Eshkol in Hebrew means cluster. So it's the... Anybody know what a wadi is?
Yeah,
what a wadi is we actually have these things in West Texas as well. We don't call them wadis. So this is the way it is. Desert areas don't get a lot of rain. But when they do get rain, they get a lot of rain. I mean, it just cuts down. And so what happens is that it's all dry, and it's all parched, and it's all this stuff. And then you get, like, a whole day of rain. Whoosh! And what happens is that you get these little rivulets where the water runs, and then the next rain comes and it just goes in the same place, right? It doesn't go in a different place, it goes in the same place. And so over and over and over and over and over, what happens? Anybody get to Big Bend, Arizona, right? What you get are these huge, incredibly deep ravines, gully washer, right? So these incredibly huge, like, these things go, I don't know, geez, 30 feet deep. Just from rain that comes all at once and then washes all that dirt and all that sand over and over and over. And so you get these incredibly long, deep ravines, usually with a little river at the bottom, a little spring at the bottom. And so this place is called the Wadi. That's called the Wadi. So the Wadi Eshkol, the Wadi Cluster. And the reason why it was called that is because of the cluster that the Israelites cut down from there. Well, it's probably called the Wadi Eshkol before the Israelites showed up because of the clusters. So it's not like, yeah, So the Canaanites came along and said, oh, let's call this the Wadi Eshkol because, you know, they've got nothing. No, it was probably called that before. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So they're there for 40 days, right? Just remember that. That's going to be important later. At the end of 40 days, they returned from spying out the land. And it came to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the Israelites in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh, which is where they started out from. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation, and they showed them the fruit of the land. And they told them, we came to the land to which you sent us, and it flows with milk and honey. That's an idiom. It doesn't actually flow with literal milk and honey. I believe in a literal Bible. Well, no, not here. It doesn't actually flow. It's an idiom in Hebrew that means that it's very, very fertile, right? It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Yay! Now, they keep talking. You know people like this, that they start talking, and then they just won't shut up, and then they start trailing off. And so, oh, this is great. Look at all this wonderful stuff, and boy, it's a great land. Yet, oh, Lordy mercy, yet the people who live in it are strong. The towns are fortified. Those towns are very large. And besides that, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Yikes! And not only that, but the Amalekites live in the land of the Negev. Now, anybody know about the Amalekites? I think we've met the Amalekites before. In fact, I'm sure we have met the Amalekites before in our story. We met them over in Exodus, actually. The Amalekites actually do know about, because these people do appear elsewhere in the Bible. Before we talk about the Amalekites, you know that in English, and in fact, I think in most languages, that there are words that have not only what are called denotations, they also have connotations, right? And that is a word not only has a dictionary form, but it also has baggage that goes along with it, right? When I say the word, for example, Nazi, right? That's a word that has a lot of baggage with it, right? I can't say the word Nazi, and the first thing that pops into your head is, oh, yes, that's a political movement that was in the 1930s in Germany, right? Social democratic, right? Exactly, that's what it is. No, that's not what you think. The first thing that you think, I mean, that's the dictionary definition of it. The first thing you think of, well, you think of a lot of things, right? When I say the word Nazi, that has a lot of baggage with it. When I say the word Amalekite in the Bible, that's a word that has a lot of baggage with it. And surprisingly, the baggage that goes along with Amalekite is very similar to the word, the baggage that goes along with Nazi. Right? These people are violent. These people are cruel. These people, they do awful, awful, awful things to people that they defeat in battle. And so not only are the descendants of Anak there, yikes, but also the Amalekites live in the land of the Negev, that is in the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites live in the hill country, that is in the middle. And the Canaanites live by the sea along the Jordan. So there's tons of people all over the place already. They're all wicked people. They're all wicked, cruel people. And if we try to go up there and try to take the place, it's not going to go well for us. Oh, well. Maybe we can go someplace else. Maybe Tampa, Florida is open. I don't know. No. This is the land that God promised from a long time ago. But Caleb, right? So he's one of the people that went up. Caleb, he's the third one in the list. Caleb quieted the people before Moses. Said, no. And when he says he quieted the people before Moses, the people that he's quieting are those other spies. Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, shut up. Let's go up at once and occupy it because we're well able. We're able to overcome it. And then the men who had gone up with him said, no, we're not able to go up against this people. They're stronger than we are. And so they brought to the Israelites an unfavorable report of the land that they had spied out, saying, the land that we have gone through as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. You notice how the report, every time they tell me the report, it gets worse and worse and worse. First of all, the report is, oh, this is its fruit. Oh, yeah, and we also saw the sons of Anak there, like Akikam and those other guys. But then it's like, suddenly it's like, oh, not only that, but the Nazis are all over the place, right? And the Hittites are here, and the Philistines are here, and it's like, ah! And not only that, but by this telling, it's like the land actually devours. the people that live there. It's like the ground opens up and eats people. We better stop while we're ahead, right? So, the land that we've gone through with spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are great size, they're huge, right? And also, we saw the Nephilim. The Anakites come from the Nephilim. The Nephilim, the only place that this occurs is before the flood. You remember Noah? That was like 15 years ago when we covered that. Before the flood, there were these people that were horrible people called the Nephilim. Funny thing about the flood, I don't know if you remember this, the flood kills everybody. Everybody, except Noah and everybody in the ark. It kills everybody, wipes everybody out. Not according to the spies. Those Nephilim, they're still around, and they're living in that land. This is a bald-faced lie. We also saw the Nephilim. You know what? The Anakites come from the Nephilim. And to ourselves, we seem like grasshoppers, and that's what we look like to them. Because, of course, I was able to crawl inside their brains and look out through their eyes and know exactly what they think about. It's really funny. You go to Bible dictionaries or something, and you'll look up Anakites. And one of the things that the Bible dictionary will say is that the Anakites are descendants from the Nephilim. Mm. And it will quote this little speech right here to prove that the Anakites are descendants from the Nephilim. The problem is, this is a bald-faced lie. In the context, it's a bald-faced lie. It's obviously not true. And so it's people that write Bible dictionaries are some. Yeah. But anyway, you don't take a look at the context. You just quote. Bible says, right there. Not a good report. It's just getting worse and worse and worse. And then the congregation, of course, raised a loud cry. And the people wept all that night. And then, how many people have been coming to Numbers so far? This little class? Yeah, somewhat ready? Yeah, so you know what's going to happen next, right? Exactly, right there. They start complaining. Because that's all the people do in Numbers, right? And they start complaining, right? And they complain against Moses and Aaron, just like they did last week, and just like they did the week before, and just like they did the week before. And in fact, all those stories that we didn't read in Numbers, exactly like those stories. The Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, I wish we had died while we were in Egypt. I wish we had died while we were in the land of Egypt. Oh, I wish that we had actually died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become hostages, right? Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt? And that's what they said to one another. Let's choose a captain. Let's go back to Egypt. Yeah, because things are so wonderful. Remember that? When they used to like knock you upside the head with a baseball bat every day? Yeah, that was wonderful. Let's choose a captain. Let's go back to Egypt. And then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the Israelites. They're just literally knocked off their feet, right? Joshua, the son of Nun, who was number five on the list. Yep, number five on the list. So Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, they tore their clothes, which is the way... they're not doing striptease. In most cultures, if you're out at the mall and you see, let's just say a woman, and she's dressed all in black and she has a black hat on and she has a veil in front of her face, right? And she's whatever there, you know certain things about her just by the way in which she appears, right? And that is, she has, you tell me.
She's
what? She's a god. Probably not a god. She's an older woman, let's say that. She's in mourning, or she's lost somebody very important to her. She's what? Oh, she's Muslim, right, with the mayor, right? But perhaps she's in mourning, right, because cultures, with these major transitional phases in one's life, certain cultures show that transitional phase in certain ways. In the ancient world, when one is upset, one of the ways that one shows that is by wearing torn clothes. So a woman that might have lost her husband, she wouldn't be at Walmart wearing all black. She would be there, and her dress would be torn or something like this, and you would see her, and she'd be, and you'd think, you wouldn't think, oh my God, she has a torn dress. You would think, oh my God, she's lost someone important to her. So that's what they do. They tore their clothes. Joshua and Caleb tear their clothes because they're upset. And they said to all the congregation of the Israelites, "The land that we went through as spies is an exceedingly good land. And if the Lord is pleased with us, as he clearly is, he's brought us all this way, he's going to bring us into this land and give it to us. And it's a land that flows with milk and honey. It's a very fertile land. But he doesn't just do that automatically. He doesn't force you to do anything, right? Only don't rebel against the Lord. Don't be afraid of the people of the land, because they're no more than bread for us. They have all this stuff, and that's all that stuff is just for us, right? Their protection is removed from them. The Lord is with us. Don't be afraid of them." But the whole congregation threatened to stone them. Things are getting out of hand, right? Then the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the Israelites. Uh-oh. Daddy showed up, right? "The glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of the meeting to all the Israelites, and the Lord said to Moses, 'How long will this people despise me? How long will they refuse to believe in me?'" Right? Since the time that they left, and this is so, so, so important, since the time that they left Egypt, God has taken care of them all along the way. God, in a phrase from Exodus, God has brought them to himself on eagle's wings, right? The trip has been as easy as it could be. God has taken care of all of their needs. God has talked to them himself. They have heard his own voice from the top of Sinai. God has clearly laid out for them the best way that they are to live. God hasn't hidden anything from them. God has not abused them. God has not... And yet all they want to do is complain. All they want to do is despise me. How long will this people despise me? How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the signs that I have done among them? So I'm going to strike them with pestilence. I'm going to disinherit them. And I will make of you, Moses, a nation greater and mightier than they. So that whole Abraham shtick, we're just getting rid of all of these people. And we're going to start all over with you, Moses. And Moses says, awesome! Yes, thank you, because I hate them too. I think you're absolutely right. No, Moses actually doesn't. And just notice this paragraph. This is an extremely long paragraph. This is one of the longest speeches in the entire Bible. I don't know if you know much, if you've read many Bible stories, but usually speeches are rather short, as we've seen before. 4, 5, 6 sentences. Just notice how long this is. Moses said to the Lord, "You don't want to do that. You don't want to wipe out the people. You don't want to do that. Because," and just notice, and again, people often make fun of this, but actually I think that there's something going on here. Moses says to the Lord, "Then the Egyptians are going to hear about it. Because in your might, you brought up this people from among them. And they're going to tell the inhabitants of this land that they have heard that you, O Lord, are in the midst of this people, because you, O Lord, you're seen face to face." Right? You're not like an idol. You're not something, you know. We've actually experienced you on Sinai. Right? You're seen face to face. "And in your cloud stands over them. And you go in front of them in a pillar of cloud by day and in a pillar of fire by night." Right? You're actually leading these people. "And if you kill this people all at one time, then the nations who have heard about you will say, 'Oh, it's because the Lord wasn't able to bring this people into the land that he swore to give them, that he has slaughtered them in the wilderness.' And so therefore, let the power of the Lord be great. Let the power of the Lord be great in the way that you promised when you spoke, saying, 'The Lord is slow to anger.'" If, God, you want to show your great power, killing everyone is not the way you do it. If you want to show your great power, there is nothing more powerful than mercy. There is nothing more powerful than grace. There is nothing more powerful than love. If you want to do this, then you show your great power in the same way that you spoke, saying, and it's really interesting, how many people went to church this morning at 9? Yeah. This was actually quoted in the book of Jonah. At the 4th chapter, Jonah actually quotes Numbers here. It's actually, I was there, and it was like, and one of the songs we sang actually brought this little phrase up as well. It's really kind of, it was like, wow, how fortunate. It's a sign. And he says, the Lord is slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but by no means clearing the guilty, right? It's an interesting tension there. You notice that? We always like the first part. We don't like the second part, unless we're dealing with people that have hurt us. And then we like the second part. We don't like the first part. It's funny how we sort of fall off on one side of the fence or the other. God doesn't fall off on one side of the fence or the other. Both those things are held in tension. Actually, I went to a Bible study this past Wednesday. We actually talked about this, how God's grace, the fact that God is gracious, and the fact that actions have consequences, both of those things are true. Both of those things have been true since the beginning, and both of those things are going to be true perhaps even past the end. God is gracious. Actions have consequences. And just because God is gracious doesn't mean whatever it is that you do doesn't have consequences. And just because what you do has consequences doesn't mean that God isn't gracious. Both of those things are true. How? How, Roy? How are those both of those things? How do we reconcile them? I don't know. I'm not a theologian, I just read the Bible. But I do know that both of those things are true. The Lord is slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, forgiving iniquity and transgression. And also, you know what? Actions have consequences. The way in which people live, if they live their lives, and I'm not talking about like instances of sin, doing bad things. No, I'm talking about the way in which one lives one's life, one's lifestyle. The overwhelming way in which your life is directed. Because I can tell you the way in which these people's lives have been directed, and we've seen it. And you know, not just one story. Over and over and over and over and over and over. These people are never satisfied. That has consequences. And God is gracious. Lord is slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but by no means clearing the guilty. And here's a little phrase that we've seen in Exodus before, and I have to just say a little bit. Visiting the iniquity of the parents upon the children to the third and fourth generation. That whenever people live lives, and again, it's not just messing up. Whenever people live lives of selfishness, of greed, of cruelty, when people live their whole life surrounded and bringing forth nothing but violence, day after day, month after month, year after year, when that type of atmosphere is the atmosphere in which children grow up, it's next to impossible for those children to grow up without living lives of violence and cruelty. You know this as well as I do. Actions have consequences. Jesus himself says it. You're a gracious Jesus. Just like a person sows, that's what they reap. Sort of the way the world is set up. And yes, God is gracious. But I can tell you, you plant an orange seed, you're not going to get a bunch of grapes. You're going to get an orange tree. That's the way things are set up. You sow violence, you're going to get violence. What's interesting here is visiting the iniquity of the parents upon the children to the third and fourth generation. What I'm expecting, because actions have consequences, is what I'm expecting is visiting the iniquity of the parents upon the children to the thousandth generation. That's what I'm expecting, is that once that violence is sown, it lasts forever. But just notice it doesn't last forever. It's not just easily reconciled. It's not just easily taken care of. We don't just sort of sweep it under the rug. But it doesn't last forever. So, God, forgive the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of your steadfast love. just as you have pardoned this people from Egypt even to now. You know what? One more time, forgive. And the Lord said, okay. All right, I will. I'll forgive. Just as you've asked. However, nevertheless, as I live, and as all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. It's a funny thing, that little phrase that's thrown in there. And again, somebody, I think it might have been you last week, is that you, I can't remember if it was, but somebody asked, you know, do you think that X, Y, or Z is significant in the text? And the answer is yes. I think it is significant. There's nothing thrown away here. Right? There's not a single phrase here. Again, because we only have 40 minutes or so, we have to, like, there's not a single phrase here that you can't talk a whole class on, right? Just notice how, nevertheless, as I live, and as all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, boom, none of the people who, blah, 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 blah. That little phrase in there, just as the glory of the Lord is going to fill the earth, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, for me at least, that's significant. Because it goes exactly right back to Moses' whole argument. And that is, God, you don't want to wipe all these people out all at once. You know why? Because everybody's watching. And everybody's trying to find out what kind of God you are. You need to witness to what kind of God you are. And the way in which you do that is by the greatness of your power. And the greatness of your power is actually found in forgiveness. And God says, all right, you're right, absolutely right. Forgive. But you know what? On the other hand, because all the earth is going to be filled with the glory of the Lord, just because this argument that you yourself have brought up, right? Just because everybody is watching, I'm not a pushover. Just because I forgive doesn't mean that actions don't have consequences. As I live, and as all the earth is going to be filled with the glory of the Lord, everybody's watching. None of the people who have seen my glory and the signs that I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and yet have tested me these 10 times and have not obeyed my voice, none of those people are going to see the land that I swore to give their ancestors. None of those who despise me are going to see it. Oscar Wilde. Anybody know who Oscar Wilde is? Oscar Wilde once said, the only thing worse than not getting what you want is getting it. We don't want to see the land. Okay. Excellent. We want to go back to Egypt. Okay. That's great. Splendid. Let's go. You don't want the land? That's fine. We're not going to get the land. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit and has followed me wholeheartedly, I'm going to bring him into the land into which he went, and his descendants are going to possess it. And now, since the Amalekites and the Canaanites live in the valley, since you're so afraid of all these people,
and are up here, you know which way you're going to start going? In the exact opposite direction. So,
remember where you were when you left Egypt? That was right, the Red Sea. So, since you don't want to go north, let's go south. Turn tomorrow and set out for the wilderness, by the way, to the Red Sea. And you know what they do for 40 years? Notice the spies were in the land for 40 days. What they do for 40 years? They make that same trek from the Red Sea to Sinai to Kadesh Barnea to the Red Sea to Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. They make that same thing. A trip that takes less than 6 months.
Wow.
Over and over and over. I'm not going to do this 40 times. But over and over and over. Until finally, all of these people, this whole generation, is gone. Their children, who were born in the wilderness, who were born after, or who perhaps were there at the crossing, but were so small they don't remember it. Those children grow up, and they're the ones that actually cross over and eventually will take the land in Joshua, in the book of Joshua. At the end of, we need to stop. At the end of Numbers. From now at least until Christmas, our Christmas break. And the reason why? Because Deuteronomy is my favorite book of the Bible. it really is. Deuteronomy is my favorite book of the Bible. What about the Gospel of Matthew? No, Deuteronomy trumps it. I shouldn't say that. Deuteronomy is better than, Deuteronomy. I can tell you. Boy, this is, maybe we should stop on this. I can tell you that if there were no Deuteronomy, there would be no Gospel of Matthew. If there were no Deuteronomy, there would be no New Testament, at least in the form that we have it. And the reason why is the way in which we interpret Scripture as Christians, the way in which we learn how to do that, the way in which Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul, Peter, all those writers in the New Testament, the way in which they learn how to interpret Scripture, they learn that from Deuteronomy. Seems to me a good thing to sit around and think about for a while. Because if you can understand Deuteronomy, you don't need the New Testament. You need Christ! Let's be clear about that. We're Christians. Well, Episcopalians. So if you get the principles here, you'll understand exactly what's going on there. So anyway, thank you very much. Sorry I kept you late.